All right. It's time for our final panel of the day, legalization and public activism. I would like to introduce our moderator, Jamie Shaw. Jamie is both a former director and former staff at the BC Compassion Club Society, where her work was comprised of various roles, including communications, beginning in 2012. Jamie has also served three terms on the board of directors at the Canadian Association of Medical Cannabis Dispensaries, CAMCD, 2.5 of those as president. Her successful lobbying in Vancouver led not only to the city implementing licensing for dispensaries under prohibition, but also to the creation of a second class of licensing based heavily on the BCCS model. I apologize for that, Jamie. And requiring membership in CAMCD. She's also the co-founder of the first Canadian chapter of Women Grow in Vancouver and a writer for the cannabis resource website, Canleo. Sorry,
that's okay.
There we go. Please welcome Jamie and our panel.
My panel looks to be a little light at the moment, but I do see Kirk. So we will start with Kirk Tusa. Exactly. Kirk Tusa is a barrister and advocate for law reform. His primary practice areas are medical cannabis regulatory compliance, cannabis criminal defense, and strategic litigation. In addition to the daily practice of law, Kirk sits on the boards of the British Columbia Civil Liberties Association, Normal Canada, MAPS Canada, and the Sensible BC Society. Kirk has written and spoken extensively on issues related to drug policy. You're not going to take a seat? It's a panel discussion.
I thought we'd
Well, you may have the whole time. I don't say. So Kirk has written and spoken extensively on issues related to drug policy, privacy, religious freedom, and criminal justice policy. He has testified several times before the House of Commons and the Senate and litigated the first medical cannabis case to be heard by the Supreme Court of Canada. Kirk Tusa.
Dana, bravo, Kirk.
Next, we have Jody Emery. Jody is a political activist, public speaker, and longtime marijuana legalization advocate. Together with her famous activist husband, Mark Emery, who's not sitting next to her, she owns and operates Cannabis Culture Stores, Cannabis Culture Vapor Lounges, Cannabis Culture News, and Pot TV. Jody is invited to speak at a variety of conferences and rallies in Canada and the United States, and is regularly featured in mainstream media stories about cannabis, prohibition, and legalization. She's also often asked to provide media commentary on other topics, including policing, taxation, war, and the environment. Jody has run for provincial office 4 times, including 2 BC Green Party election bids. In 2014, she campaigned for the Federal Liberal Party of Canada nominations in Vancouver East. Jody Emery. Next to Jody is Mark Hayden. He's an adjunct professor at the University of British Columbia and teaches in the UBC School of Population and Public Health, Nursing, Social Work, and Medicine. He is the chair of the board of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, MAPS Canada. He has published on the issue of drug control policy in the following journals: Canadian Journal of Public Health, International Journal of Drug Policy, Encyclopedia of Public Health, Harm Reduction Journal, and Open Medicine. Mark has worked for the Addiction Services for 28 years and currently works with the Health Officers Council of British Columbia on their position papers on the issue of a regulated market for all currently illegal drugs. He was awarded the Queen's Diamond Jubilee Medal for drug policy reform work in 2013, and he's also someone I quote extensively whenever I'm talking to parent groups or school boards. Mark Hayden. Sorry, they're not sitting in order, so I'm going to go all over the script here. Next, we have Dana Larson. Dana is a well-known Vancouver cannabis activist, businessman, and politician. He served 10 years as editor of Cannabis Culture magazine, is the co-founder of the Vancouver Seed Bank, founder of the Vancouver Dispensary Society, and was vice president of the Canadian Association of Medical Cannabis Dispensaries. Larson was a founding member of the BC Marijuana Party and the Canadian Marijuana Party. In 2003, he joined the NDP, running as an NDP candidate in 2008. In 2011, he ran for leadership of the BC NDP. Larson is also founder and director of Sensible BC, Canada's largest grassroots cannabis reform organization. Larson is the author of several books, including Harry Harry Pothead and the Marijuana Stone, and the recently released Green Buds and Hash, as well as the Illustrated History of Cannabis in Canada. And last but certainly not least, we have Mark Emery, the world-famous Prince of Pot. He's known for his essential involvement in the marijuana movement since 1991. He helped make marijuana books and magazines legal in Canada, sold bongs and vaporizers when it was illegal to do so, created Cannabis Culture magazine, founded Pot TV, and campaigned in elections at all levels of government since 1980. Mark is most recognized for selling marijuana seeds to the United States and worldwide when no one else would, donating millions of dollars to political groups, election campaigns, court cases, and activist organizations. He was freed from the U.S. federal prison in 2014 after being extradited in 2010 and now operates his Cannabis Culture stores and vapor lounges, Cannabis Culture News, and Pot TV with his wife, Jody. Welcome, Mark. So this panel discussion is, the title of it is actually two topics and not one, and each topic probably could have had its own panel. And I could literally listen to each one of these people speak for at least 2 hours. So we're going to have a bit of a problem getting this into 20 minutes, especially when I'm going to start off by talking about my bracelet. One of the links in this bracelet says I read banned books, and all of the other links in it are cover art from books that have been banned. So to start off our conversation, Mark Emery, you were an activist as a bookstore owner in London, Ontario. So how would you define what is an activist?
An activist who does something on principle and without any personal gain. So I've always said you're not an activist if the police charge you and you try and defend yourself in court because you're looking after your own survival. You know, your own personal interest is very much at stake. So when we advocate for a principle that we do not gain by, that's activism. Now, sometimes we do gain by it. So, you know, that's when we have to question how much is self-interest and how much is actual public interest.
Thank you. That actually was going to ask this question later, but that leads into it fairly well. In cannabis, public activism and civil disobedience often go hand in hand with some sort of business or monetary gain. When Mark was sentenced to jail in the United States, Jody, you picked up both of those responsibilities, both the activism and the business. How do you see the balance between those two, between the business interests and activism?
Part of what inspired me about Mark's activism when I first found out about him was that he was not ashamed to say that you need to make money to make a difference. No charity can help anyone who's poor or hungry if they don't have money. No political party can do any political activity without donations and money. Everything we require from all of us here, we all pay rent, we buy food, we all need money. And money is required to do good, just as money is used to do evil. So money itself isn't bad, but a lot of people let their desire for money allow them to compromise their principles and morals to do bad things. But there are a lot of people in this world who have money and make money to give away, to do good with. Like all these social events and fundraisers, you know, these black tie events that I haven't ever been to and many of us haven't, but at least they're using money to give to something, and the something that gets the money needed it. So using a business to create money to finance a cause, but also to pay your own bills and keep a roof over your head, isn't something to be ashamed of. In fact, it's required. A broke activist can't really do much except use free public Wi-Fi to post on Facebook or to do something on their own with their limited means. But if you're not able to create funds and money, you're not going to actually be able to print handouts. You're not going to be able to buy medical marijuana to sell to people who need it. You're not going to be able to do anything without money. And that's why so many groups here are nonprofit, but they seek money because without that money, they can't do the good that they do. So business is required for activism to be successful. And a lot of people find their own personal freedom and liberty through being self-employed and creating a business and hiring others. For myself, running our lounge, I have 36 employees in our lounge, store, media, and seeing some of them come up with their own little side business and they're making money selling a product and they're branding and they're partnering with friends, and that's a wonderful thing. And wouldn't we all be so lucky to benefit from the economic freedom that marijuana can provide us all? and which is also required at this time to change the laws so we can have that freedom.
Thank you. Yeah. We're going to actually talk a little bit right after. I'm going to do Kirk first. Yeah, because we're going to come back to activism a little bit. But the other half of the title was legalization. So we're going to come back to, we'll go a little bit more into legalization and then kind of come back and marry the two together. One of the proudest moments in my life actually was reading Justice Phelan's ruling and seeing that my testimony had actually affected him. Being able to affect a judge like that is something that Mr. Tussaud makes a career out of. So Kirk, you wanted to kind of talk a little bit about home growing and how that fits within basically the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, in particular Section 7.
Yeah, thank you, Jamie, and thank you for your testimony, and Allard. And I just want to take a moment to recognize the people that have pioneered this industry. You saw some of them on the panel immediately before this one, who put their liberty at risk every day in order to advance social acceptance of cannabis and medical cannabis in order to advance political and legal goals. We hear a lot of discussion now about what legalization is going to look like, legislation anticipated in the spring of 2017, and I wanted to just make a few comments on home production or personal production of recreational or adult use cannabis and how that fits into the charter. I think there's a general misunderstanding of what the charter analysis looks like. You know, because we talk about whether there's a right to grow at home or a right to grow medical cannabis at home, and that's really the wrong question. And it's the wrong question for this reason. In a free and democratic society that is committed to principles of individual autonomy and maximizing individual choice, the starting point is not what they will allow you to do. The starting point is liberty and what constrains the government's ability to restrict your liberty. Canada is not a parliamentary democracy any longer. Canada is a constitutional democracy with the enshrinement of the Charter. And Section 7 of the Charter says to government, it's a restriction on government conduct. It says to the government that you are not entitled to infringe the life, the liberty, or the security of the person of any Canadian citizen unless you do so in accordance with the principles of fundamental justice. Now, that's a pretty heavy phrase, so let's unpack it a little bit. The analysis in the courts are, number one, can you demonstrate on a balance of probabilities that your rights have been infringed? And so let's look at the case of a legal cannabis environment in which there's a criminal prohibition still in place on growing for yourself, growing this plant for yourself. Clearly, your liberty interests have been infringed because there is a criminal prohibition restricting your individual conduct. That's the case anytime there's a criminal prohibition that restricts any of your individual conduct. So the rights infringement portion of the analysis, the first part where you ask, has liberty been infringed, has to be answered in the positive anytime there's a criminal prohibition. I would go further to say there's also a restriction on your security of the person. Your security of the person is what protects your ability to make autonomous choices about things that are serious and important to you as an individual. It's your conception of what the good is in your own life. And I say that when you're criminally restricted from growing this plant, your security of the person is also implicated. So let's ask then what the second part of the analysis is. Does that restriction accord with the principles of fundamental justice? Now, what are they? Very interestingly, the first case of the Supreme Court of Canada to determine Section 7 and its relationship to cannabis was the Malma Levine, Clay, and Kane case. David was up here earlier. He's one of the early warriors on this. And as he said, he represented himself in the Supreme Court of Canada. Video's available online. He did a great job. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court of Canada did not find that simple possession, the ban on simple possession, offended the Charter. The difference, though, is that since that decision, there's been a fairly significant development in the law about what we understand the principles of fundamental justice to be. And so in the context of a criminal prohibition, those principles of fundamental justice are, is the law arbitrary? Well, what does that mean? It means, does the law achieve its purpose, or does, in fact, it act contrary to its purpose? The purpose of the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act is the protection of public health and safety. That was found by the Supreme Court of Canada in the Smith case. It was confirmed by the federal judge in Allard. And so what we were able to demonstrate in Allard, with Jamie's help and the help of many other people, is that the MMPR restricted individual liberty, and it did so in a manner that actually made people's health worse. It actually impacted their safety and their health in a negative way. Well, a law that is designed to protect public health and safety, but in fact has the opposite result, is arbitrary. And so I would say to you that a restriction on personal production of cannabis in an otherwise legal environment is arbitrary, because the only outcome of that restriction, that criminal restriction, is a negative impact both on the individual's health and safety and on the public health and safety, because the activity will be driven underground and into the black market. There's another principle of fundamental justice known as overbreadth. That's when a law, otherwise rational on its face, in any individual circumstance goes too far. And again, we saw that in Allard. Yes, it's true that you can grow cannabis quite dangerously. That does occur from time to time. But for any individual person, you can grow it perfectly safely with no detrimental impacts either to your own or to communities' health and safety. And so for each individual plaintiff in Allard, the government was unable to demonstrate that the purpose of the statute, protection of health and safety, was implicated in that person's case, and therefore the law was also overbroad. There's a third principle called the principle of gross disproportionality, which stands for the basic proposition that the punishment can't be grossly more severe than the harm to be prevented. And I would say that if you can go to the store and buy cannabis, if you can have a business selling cannabis and making money lawfully in a social use or adult use way, how then can you visit the criminal consequences, including jail, locking human beings in cages, on people who are growing that self-same plant at home with no risk to others for their own personal consumption? I say you can't do that and have a law that is consistent with Section 7 of the Charter. And so when we talk about what legalization might look like, and I hear the government may or may not be considering home production, the reality is if there's no home production, if there's no right to produce this plant for yourself, not for commercial purposes, but for yourself or for non-commercial trading with your friends like you can with all manner of other things, then it's not truly legalization, and the lawsuit will be filed the day after the law is brought into effect, and we'll have to go back to court and fight for these rights as we have so many times over the past 20 years on this issue. So I hope not to have to do that, quite frankly, but I'm certainly ready to do it if it becomes necessary to do so, and I believe we would win.
I've always had a bit of a problem with the public health arguments, not that I feel that they're not important, but that I feel that they overly focus on the harms and they don't really consider possible benefits very much. So trying to balance real public health concerns against imaginary public health concerns and how that was going to fit into legalization, do you have any thoughts on that, Mark?
Funny that you ask. Sure, I'd like to comment on both what Kirk and Jody have said. There's a number of issues coming down the federal government pipe at us that I'd love to look at from the public health perspective. So should the dispensaries be part of the next system is a very interesting question. And the public health argument essentially says yes. But the reason for it is an interesting one. There's an author out there named Wilkinson who wrote a book called The Spirit Level that did a wonderful analysis of social problems in our society, everything from low birth weight babies to murder rates to addiction rates. And what he said is one of those compelling drivers of problems in all societies, inegalitarianism, which means the distance between the rich and the poor. If you have a society that concentrates wealth at the top of the pyramid, it tends to be a very sick society, and you have many social problems resulting from that. So if we build a system that sells cannabis that concentrates money at the top of the pile, we will have a sicker society than if we spread the money around. So the dispensaries, by definition, tend to be very small. They're individuals, people sitting at the table, or small groups of people. They're not large multinational corporations. And so in a public health argument, you'd keep the existing dispensaries, you'd require them to stay relatively small, and you'd have lots of them. That's an egalitarian argument.
Thank you. Yeah. And just before we get into like more fuller discussion points, I'd like to a few words from Dana, who actually I feel kind of has bridged this gap fairly well. He's stayed very relevant as an activist. Movements like Overgrow Canada really keep up with the changing game board. And what do you think is next? How can activists keep evolving at this stage where we're in this kind of in-between period?
Well, that's why I started giving away the seeds, I guess, because I feel like growing is the final frontier of what we want, everybody to be able to grow their own. And this has been a 20-year civil disobedience campaign. You know, Mark really launched it with the information and the literature and bongs and then seeds, and the dispensaries have picked it up, and that's been a huge area of growth. And, you know, a lot of dispensaries are not really so medical anymore and just selling to everybody, which I think is very good. And but people still can't grow openly, right? And that's still the thing that's not really allowed yet. And so I thought giving away seeds to encourage everybody to grow was kind of the next phase in that. And I don't really know where you go beyond that. I mean, other than sort of pushing, we've all the things that we've got, we need to push to have more and more. But if everybody can grow their own, and if we've got independently run dispensaries selling cannabis to people, and if we've got access to vapor lounges and bong shops and information, that's kind of what we want, really, in terms of what our culture, you know, what we want to have available. So I don't really know where to go beyond that, other than actually changing the law. Mm-hmm. You know, the civil disobedience campaign is great, but we're still living under Harper's laws. And in fact, in terms of changing the laws in Canada so far, our movement has been terrible. The laws have only gotten worse over the last 20 years. But the enforcement of those laws, the reality on the ground, public opinion, court decisions, in every other way, it's been great. But the laws that Parliament passes have not gotten any better yet. Hopefully we got a good one coming down the pipe, right? But so that's how I see it, and I feel our campaign is going to have to continue, and whatever they put in is not going to be good enough, right? Legalization 1.0 is going to be better than prohibition, but not a lot, and we're going to have to keep pushing, and whatever parts in there we don't like, we got to keep breaking those laws and keep doing it until we get to legalization version 7 or 8, where we start getting the kind of system that we're actually looking for, right? So that's how I see it. It'll be an ongoing campaign for a long time. And civil disobedience certainly isn't the only part, but it's a key aspect. But it takes all these things, you know, political work, civil disobedience, public opinion, working at all levels of government and all different parts. So all these things come together to make change. But civil disobedience, I think, is a big driver in terms of if everyone's already breaking the law and nobody cares anymore, it's pretty easy to change the law at that point because everybody already thinks it's done, right? So that's how I see it.
That's true. Yeah, thank you. This is, of course, what's also leading to tension right now, because we've been told we're going to be legalized. We've been told that it's going to be based on best evidence and on public health. But what we've really been hearing back in terms of what they have considered best evidence in public health hasn't really been overly reassuring. Mark, did you have comments on what Dana had said?
Sure. Version one is cannabis. I'd like to speculate as to what version two is. I'm taking off my public health hat for a second, and I'm putting on my MAPS hat, which is the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. Cannabis is first, psychedelics are second. And quite frankly, heroin and cocaine are third and fourth. You know, all currently illegal drugs need to be part of this. Cannabis just opened... Yes, cannabis is a gateway drug.
Yes.
It's a gateway to legalization. That's the gateway. And so we need to continue the process. The beginning is cannabis.
Nice. Yeah, and that's something that AC Braddock had mentioned in one of the panels yesterday that has always been what my thought about cannabis was, is that it was the plant that was not going to fit in the box, no matter how hard they tried to put it in that box. And once they realized it doesn't fit in that box, maybe other plants don't fit in that box as well. Dana, do you have a...
Well, I would just say I think it's going to be the same path, where I think medicalization of psychedelics will be the thing, right? It's easy to say no to some kid who wants to take it on the weekend, but a veteran who's got PTSD and he needs MDMA, it's a lot harder to say no to them. Yeah. And then just like with cannabis, you start realizing, well, if it's good for the person who's sick, it's also good to help prevent those kind of things. It's also maybe good for regular people to use in the right context as a preventative, mm-hmm. or as a, you know, whatever, right? There's lots of studies showing that, you know, magic mushrooms, even a single experience, can change your whole life outlook in very positive ways. So I think we'll see the same kind of, the vulnerable groups that are hard to say no to will be in the front, and that will kind of normalize these things for other people, and then we see, well, it's good for everybody, really, right? So,
yeah, nice. Kirk, I just wanted to get back a little bit to home growing within legalization. The deadline's coming in fairly soon for when we're supposed to see some sort of draft around the medical. So do you think they're going to try and tackle like a medical patients are allowed to grow first and then maybe include that into legalization?
Well, certainly the Allard ruling requires the government to address the constitutional deficiencies of the MMPR by the 24th of August. Now, that clock's ticking relatively quickly. It does not appear from an outsider's perspective that the government has made substantial progress towards a new regime. I suspect that they're not entirely sure what to do. And I suspect largely the reason they're not entirely sure what to do is that Justice Phelan kept jurisdiction and kept the injunction alive that protects so many patients, former MMAR patients and producers, and said essentially that the injunction lives until further order of the court. Now, as a practical matter, what does that mean? In the past, when the government has responded to declarations of constitutional invalidity, they've moved inches rather than miles. They've taken very incremental steps towards constitutionality. I've argued in court unsuccessfully, but will continue to argue, that those responses have been contemptuous of the decisions of the courts. In effect, they've thumbed their noses at the ongoing constitutional dialogue between the courts and the legislature in a charter-based democracy. By taking these tiny little steps. The difficulty is, I think they'd like to take a tiny little step in response to Allard. I think they'd like to implement some kind of like five-plant hard cap on medical producers if you have a permit from your doctor, and then just revitalize the MMPR as the commercial distribution avenue, perhaps with some retail component through pharmacies or the like included. The difficulty with that approach is they're not going to get rid of the injunction by doing that. We've educated Justice Phelan enough that he understands that if you can't justify any prohibition on home production in the context of a lengthy charter trial with tons of expert witnesses, the entire resources of the government of Canada at your disposal, bringing in experts from all over the world if you're the government of Canada, and you can't even justify the restrictions on all of our plaintiffs, by the way, all of whom could produce in excess of 100 plants each, it's going to be very difficult to go before that justice again and say, well, we fixed it, Judge. People can all grow five plants now, because the arbitrariness problem remains. It is just as safe or unsafe to grow five plants, 50 plants, 500 plants, 5,000 plants. It just depends on how you're doing it. And so I think there's a big problem there, and I don't think the government has figured out how they're going to address that problem. I can tell you that John and I and the other lawyers involved in Allard are prepared to go back to court if we need to continue to fight this battle that we've been fighting for many, many, many years in the courts. I desperately hope we don't have to do that. It is difficult. It is arduous. It is tough for the witnesses. It is tough for the lawyers. It's tough for all the people out there that don't have any ability to control the outcome of the events, and yet their very lives depend on what those outcomes are. And so the government has a real opportunity here. Quite frankly, I'm not sure why they're not simply just thinking about bringing back the MMAR for personal production and caregiver production and having the MMPR with some tweaks be the commercial distribution system. It needs a lot of tweaks, but that's beyond the scope of this panel. That seems to me to be the easiest short-term solution whilst you figure out the rest of it. But I have no idea what's in their heads, and I fear to speculate.
Yeah, fair enough. One of the big issues with diversion, of course, is why they're worried about plant numbers, and they're talking about loss of revenue, but they're also talking about access to youth, which touches on what I was talking about earlier about the public health. Right now, our colleges consider 25 to be youth. So in any sort of legal rec market, it wouldn't be anyone under 25 wouldn't actually be legal. Mark Hayden, you had some comments you wanted to make on that.
Well, the issue of access to youth, I think, is the most controversial. And there's essentially two positions out there, and I'd like to fill in the middle ground. The position of Justin Trudeau is it's a nasty drug, and if youth get a hold of it, it'll damage their brains. The position of David Malmo-Levine is it's the same as caffeine, treat it the same as caffeine. So those are two relatively divergent points of view. I've put a lot of thought into the middle ground, and I'd like to just throw out some ideas here. My position on access to youth really comes from a paper I've just finished writing on psychedelics and a post-prohibition regulatory model for psychedelics in a world of public health. And we looked at various pieces of the puzzle. Piece of the puzzle number one is there's 23 states out there that allow parents to supervise their children's alcohol consumption. Piece of the puzzle number two is ayahuasqueros and peyote traditions have always allowed youth access so long as There's parental approval, but not parental supervision. The issue of health access, if you think about the difference, how we as a province, how young people access health services, I think is relevant, because youth are divided into mature and immature minors. Mature minors being defined as those who can make their own decisions and understand what they're asking for, and immature minors being defined as those who can't. All of those examples that I've just given essentially are guided by adults in some kind of ceremonial context, or some kind of context, which is sometimes ceremonial. My observation is, my interest in drugs is historical and cross-cultural. And if I look at all drug use throughout the history of mankind, and I look at all drug use around the planet today, largely benign use of drug that's integrated into cultural uses is supervised by adults in some kind of cultural context. And so, at the end of the day, I took all of those pieces of the puzzle and wove it into this paper, basically saying, yes, youth should be able to access it. But they should be able to access cannabis with some kind of context that really we as a society haven't figured out yet. And we need to have a larger discussion of it, and it probably needs to have some guidance by elders. I find it interesting, I'm slightly off my public health hat for a second, to observe the number of people who are participating in green ceremonies now. The existence of the ayahuasqueros, who have come widely throughout North America, have raised an awareness of the issue of ceremonial structures around drug use. And that's spinning off for people who are now doing green ceremonies. In fact, there are a number of people in this room who are running green ceremonies and bringing a spiritual and healing tradition to a cannabis process. I find that absolutely fascinating. Personally, I think that's the discussion that we need to be having.
Thank you. I think we're a little bit over time already, so we should probably move to some questions, because I imagine there will be some. I just wanted to add very, very quickly that...
I'm going to throw one fast thought. My conclusion is, yes, cannabis should be accessible to youth, but it should be a ranked system. Cannabis first, alcohol second, and tobacco third, based on age.
Interesting. One of the things for me that I find is missing from most of these discussions is we've apologized for historical wrongs in other areas. We've apologized for the Komagata Maru. We've apologized for the head tax. We've apologized for residential schools. And yet we're still ignoring the knowledge and approach that the elders in these societies had towards these drugs. So that's really resonant with me in particular when you speak of that, Mark.
Okay, one quick statement, one quick question. The quick statement is, I think you mischaracterized what I say. I never say that cannabis and caffeine are the same. I say caffeine's more risky, dangerous in three categories. Cannabis is more risky in one. Caffeine is more risky in overdose deaths, overuse deaths, and withdrawal symptoms. Cannabis has higher impairment levels of novice users, which could justify some restrictions that don't apply to coffee beans. However, I do think we have to be realistic about the amount of obedience that teenagers display, which is zero. Zero obedience. They're going to use it anyway. Do we want them using it with safe point of sale and quality control, or do we want them buying off the black market from Buddy, who also is selling coke and heroin? That's really the only question we have to decide about that. And I think, would you have a problem, Mark Hayden, with a system that had 16 and over, like the Senate report recommended, buy on their own, 15 and under with parental and physician supervision also have access? Would you have any problem with that?
This feels a bit like deja vu. I keep having the same conversation with you, David. Yes.
Well, if you're going to mischaracterize my statement, I'm going to put you on the spot as punishment.
I stand corrected about your position on caffeine. Okay. So I have no problem with cannabis being made available, but the issue, again, is a ranked system. So cannabis should be more available than alcohol, and alcohol should be more available than tobacco. So a ranked system makes complete sense to me. And then I throw psychedelics in the mix, and I think some kind of supervision is required, essentially.
Where does processed food and sugar fit into that ranking system?
And there's chocolate. Let's talk about the damages and health risks of chocolate.
All caffeine. We let kids have caffeine. You know, there's anymore, too, without any limits.
Can I chime in?
Yeah.
There's also another point to be sort of elucidated from the discussion, right? Because we talk about access. Teenagers have access to cannabis. Let's, you know, when we're talking about access, we're talking about access through a legal avenue of access, right? And so I think that there's a big difference between a system in which no young person can be arrested or saddled with a criminal record arising from their use of cannabis, and a system which also then subjects young people to the influences and vagaries of capitalism as consumers being convinced that they should buy and consume more and more and more of a product that is making money for the people producing and selling it. And John Conroy and I actually had a fairly pitched argument in front of Bill Blair about this, at the end of which I sort of looked at Mr. Blair and I said, and you know, you must have thought I was the radical one first, but I'm not as crazy as Conroy. Because he favored a system where 16-year-olds could go into a store and purchase cannabis. And I said, no, I don't happen to favor that system. I happen to favor a system in which no young person or any other Canadian can face criminal consequences for accessing cannabis. But I think the decision and whether a 16 or 17 or person under the age of majority should be able to have access to it, legal access to it, is a decision that has to flow through a parent or other supervisory authority, not through a profit-motivated shopkeeper. Because at the end of the day, when cannabis is legal and becomes a commodity like everything else, it's going to be marketed, sold, and it's going to be, you know, something that puts money in people's pockets, and therefore there's a real incentive to get you to buy as much of it as possible. Anheuser-Busch spends $1 billion every year to try to sell alcohol just in North America.
The same is true for caffeine. Would you favor age limits on coffee purchases?
Well, I think I'd favor parental restrictions on accessing highly potent caffeinated substances. But, you know, caffeine, I appreciate your nuanced distinction between the risks of caffeine and cannabis, and thank you for explaining that because it helped clarify my thinking on your position as well. But the impairment piece is pretty strong, and by definition, most youths are novice users. So I think there's a pretty fundamental difference there that it's hard to get it over when you're talking about age limits. So
I do think there's also a point that we're kind of glossing over that's actually is the point. How many people in this room had alcohol before they were of the legal age of majority?
Everybody.
How many of you had cannabis before it was legal?
All right.
You know, I actually turned, I became age of majority in Alberta when I turned 18, and then I moved to Ontario before I was 19. So I became illegal again. And then I went to school in the United States where I was illegal a third time for a whole year. So there's a ridiculousness to this. I think you wanted to say a little bit more on the...
It's interesting to look at how youth use changes with legalization. So it's interesting, the Dutch youth use cannabis at about 50% of the American youth, and they've done that for 30 years. It's very low. And now that the states are legalizing cannabis, youth in the states where it's becoming legalized, youth is going down.
Yeah?
Something just came to mind I've never thought of before, but how old are young teens when they start babysitting? I think you can start babysitting when you're about 12, 13, 14. Yeah. And, you know, you're responsible for another living being who's often a baby or a child. So is the concern about kids and cannabis or young people, I mean, that bothers me too. What's a young person? What's a teen? What's a kid? You know, if 19-year-olds are kids, then, you know, we're twisting up our language here. But if a young person is responsible enough to be home alone or to babysit or to have a newspaper route of their own, are they then responsible enough to decide whether or how to use cannabis? And I haven't thought about that before, but I was 12 years old when I was taking care of somebody's kid, and I guess I was responsible enough at that time. So I don't even know. This is just amusing that came to mind. So. Yeah.
I have one quick thought about age limits is that they don't need to be the same for all cannabis products, right? A cream or a salve should be available to anybody. CBD products that don't get you high, there should be no age limits for that at all. And, you know, and maybe even... and on the other hand, maybe like a super concentrated psychedelic dose of cannabis should be a higher age limit than being able to smoke a joint or something. Something that can really, you know, I wouldn't mind seeing graduated things like that with a lot of stuff. It's the dosage and the potency that affects it more than the substance itself. So a lot of cannabis stuff, I think, should have no age limits at all.
Absolutely. Mark, you just had a question. What exactly was your thought around that? Because it does tie into age limits, absolutely. But
one of the issues is that's being floated by the federal government is should cannabis be available in liquor stores? And the public health analysis of that is actually quite straightforward, is that yes, if it replaces alcohol, because alcohol is more harmful both individually and from a community and family point of view, and no, if it increases the use of alcohol. And we actually don't know yet. There is some evidence coming out of the initial legalization experiences in the state saying that alcohol use goes down, which is actually a good thing when cannabis becomes legalized. But if we want to find out in Canada, what we do is we take four stores in two different provinces, two are urban, two rural, that have established track records in terms of the sale of alcohol, and then we sell cannabis in them, and then we see, does alcohol use go down with that experiment? And if it does, then yes, we should sell it in liquor stores, including the dispensaries. And if alcohol use goes up, we shouldn't sell it in liquor stores. And if it stays the same, then it's a political choice.
Also, if it causes people to combine them together more, that would also be a factor, right?
Absolutely.
Because even if they're not drinking, you know, if they're mixing them together more often, I'd say that's also probably a negative.
And Denmark is specifically using cannabis in programs to get people off of alcohol. So yeah, there's that issue as well. And I know people that have just done that naturally. They just stop drinking alcohol when they start smoking.
And so do you think that might be why the liquor control boards want to sell marijuana? Because they're thinking, well, first of all, some people might choose pot over booze, but maybe it's also a way to sell more booze. I don't know. We don't know how it would happen. But if they're bringing people in to buy weed, and clearly with the supply and demand being demonstrated by dispensaries, a lot of people demand access. Well, and so if they go to a booze store to get their weed, maybe they'll be tempted by that picture of Captain Rum or whoever he is, you know?
They'll be selling infused alcohol pretty quick, right? You'll have infused alcohol with cannabis together combined into one thing, which
could cause
fine,
problems
not,
too,
yeah,
even.
You know.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially if you're just still experimenting or still getting used to either one of the two substances, right? Did you have a question?
Noctis fucking right out.
Green fairy?
No.
One of the older Central American civilizations is known as the Toltecs, and there's at least one tribe that continues with the old ways. Once a year, the elders, they climb up their holy mountain, and they take heavy doses of peyote, and they base their plans for the coming year on the insights they receive from those experiences. However, they throughout the entire year, they take light doses, and they also give light doses to their children on a regular basis throughout the year. And this is a really good example of how cultural prejudices about drug use can be based much more, or I should say attitudes towards drug use can be have far more to do with cultural prejudices rather than the actual effects of the drug.
Yeah, absolutely.
Ayahuasca traditions question? Also involve infants, actually prenatal infants, children, and at all ages. All ages, people are involved with ayahuasca ceremonies.
You know, the problem is in my mind, has never really been with use. It's the same thing that Kirk was kind of mentioning earlier. It's why we need regulations. It's got nothing to do with the plant. It's once you allow somebody to make money off of it, it's people that are the problem. It's not the plant. And it's the same thing with drugs. What we find, if there's people that have certain attitudes toward drugs, certain cultures that don't have the same problems that other ones do. So trying to find that merge and that meld is really the tricky part. J-Mac.
Hi, Jim.
Hi.
I'm really high, sorry. Hi, Jim, from Pot TV. My question is to Mark Hedden. In regard to the access to marijuana in a liquor store, can I please have two reasons why you think you do, and may I offer you my reason why you can't?
So why?
So I think you asked why should cannabis be available in liquor stores? Well, I actually didn't say it should be. What I said is we don't know.
No, I heard you say you want to do it in two communities, two stores, one world, one country, which is good.
Yeah.
But I want to know why you want to do it in a liquor store and only two stores.
Well, the question is, the observation is cannabis is less harmful than alcohol. Alcohol is more harmful physically to the human body, and it's also more harm socially and families. So if cannabis replaces alcohol, that's a good thing.
My question was, why do you think it is good reason to sell cannabis in a liquor store? I'm not asking why you want that. I want to know why you think it should be sold in a liquor store. Because my opinion why it should not be put in a liquor store, for one reason, is because if somebody goes there who buys beer and weed, and they get in an accident because they smoke a joint and drink beer, how are they going to accuse? What are they going to say? They're going to be like, cannabis killed this guy. When it wasn't cannabis, it would be the alcohol, not the cannabis.
He's worried about mixing cannabis and alcohol together.
That will happen.
Actually should be sold in a liquor store. He was just saying if it actually turns out that it'll like reduce alcohol, then it might be a good idea. But he wasn't actually saying, hey,
what you're asking is a research question. Research question is, what is the relationship to cannabis sales and liquor sales? And we actually don't know yet. Yeah.
I don't want to know what the difference is. I just want to know why you want to do it. Because
if it replaces alcohol.
Yeah, it would.
Because alcohol is more harmful.
But then if it replaces alcohol, then wouldn't it become a dispensary back to square one?
That actually is one of the things that muddles this entire argument, actually, is because when they say put it in the liquor stores, do they actually mean put it in the liquor stores, or do they mean put it under the liquor board? We heard from one of the unions, for example, that you could apply for a private liquor store license, and then nothing in that license tells you you have to sell liquor. So they were looking at people being able to sell one or the other or both, and thinking that it might just sort of work in there. And then you've got the LCBO model, and in Manitoba, where they're pushing a slightly different idea of it actually being in the liquor stores for sure, and that's not what we've seen anywhere else. Even in Washington, where it went under the liquor board, that's not called the liquor board anymore. It's now called the Liquor and Cannabis Board, and they're two separate stores that are just kind of overseen by the same regulatory body. So there's a lot of questions in those proposals about what exactly they even mean.
One of the arguments brought up about for Washington State especially was that they wanted to save money by using a pre-existing bureaucracy rather than creating a whole new one. So they said, well, the alcohol distribution model already exists in Washington, so instead of duplicating this entire system with all the employees and all that you'll need, why not just put it all in that same group? But of course, as with any decision, there's consequences and negatives and positives. So I think that was a selling idea for the people. That, you know, it saves money, it reduces bureaucracy, and so I think that was one of the benefits of a liquor distribution model. But clearly, the underground market still exists in Washington, because any overregulation will lead to the continuation of the underground market.
Well, yeah, and their big mistake is the one that it looks like we're going to be making as well, where we don't bother fixing any of the problems or issues with our medical side. We just kind of move ahead with recreation and maybe end up throwing the recreational, the medical, right under the bus. That's what's going on in Washington right now. So sad to see.
Okay, thank you, Jordan, for giving me a clear answer. Thank you.
Oh, of course.
Thanks, J-Mac.
I really hate to cut this incredible panel short. I think we could really have a longer discussion. It's wonderful to have the experts come out here and get in a kind of roundtable, problem-solving way, and just kind of clarify some things that we need to understand before going forward. I really want to thank every single one of our panelists that's here for all your hard work, especially the activists who, you know, from the beginning have paved the way for us. Really. it wouldn't have been the same without all of their hard work, their commitment, and their heart. I also want to thank Jamie for all her support and being an incredible moderator. Thank you. Thank you. So just a few words before we kind of close the container of this incredible 2 days. So inspirational and so exciting and so informative to be with all of you here. I opened up this speech with a wise, so it was reverence, so honoring the plant, and that's, I think we really, really did that. We all joined together and we, put her in a new light, and that's what the community definitely needs to see. And the second thing, of course, was community, compassion, and unity. And it was so beautiful to see all of you connecting from heart space in a positive way with each other. I hope that that will continue as we go forward. It was really, like, the feedback that we got, Jay and the Cambridge team, how such an incredible job, again, for putting this event on. Yeah, thank you. The two feedback that we got was no longer why are we doing this? It was when and where are we going to do this again? And so continuing that conversation forward with at least once a year for us to come back together, ground in, and have a community update about what's going on so we're all in the know. The last reason of why I felt like we were here, of course, is the responsibility and stewardship for our planet, and that was also really taken care of. I loved what anandamide represents for us right now. That was the endogenous cannabinoid neurotransmitter that was discovered by Dr. Hanus, and it's all about bliss and balance. So as long as we take that away from this conference, staying in your bliss, staying in your balance, in the equilibrium of your internal state, we can project that out into our world and be able to create the internal world outwards. So I really invite all of us to commit to that. Now, before I finish, just a few thank yous as well. So of course, we wouldn't have been able to do this event without our sponsors and the exhibitors. The exhibitors are conscious community, conscious business, and they help support the platform for education and also engagement. So thank you so much to each and every single exhibitor that came and invested that time, invested that, as Jody said, the currency that allows us to be able to keep doing this advocacy work and forward movement. I also want to thank Crop King Seeds, Kyle and his team, for their incredible support as our top sponsor. Namaste Vapors, thank you so much. Cannabis Growers of Canada, as well as the online dispensary, they were together in the sponsorship. I want to thank Moda, MJ Freeway, Canutra, as well as, of course, I forgot to mention these two friends, Mike and Carmel. Carmel's in the middle sitting there. They just so generously gave their time as far as our social media, just getting our ads out. They didn't ask for anything, and I really just want to appreciate your support and help in that, definitely. Thank you. Some logistics also, just a few things. Please return anything that you found, including cell phones, just up here. Just pass it to me. I'll make sure that we put it online so people can get it. Please give us some feedback. This is the People's Plant, the People's Conference. So whatever you guys feel that we need to improve on, maybe next year we got to close off the space because it was incredible what was happening here. There was so much magic. I also want to reiterate that the CBD project, Martin A. Lee, who's one of our esteemed speakers here, he's giving 2 hours of his time for free to the community. So write this down. It's the Waterfall Gallery at Granville Island. Beautiful art gallery where he's going to be speaking tomorrow, continuing the CBD talk from 6:30 until 8:30. It's going to be catered with some great food. Come out and listen to him. There he is, Martin. Thank you so much for coming all the way from California and continuing that gifting of your time and expertise. Miss D has a really fun night planned for you guys at the Sand, so make sure you guys go and check out the reggae night there tonight, just continuing the good vibes. Yeah, so I also just want to say happy birthday to my partner, Samir, who's right there. So such an incredible light and love in my life. I really wouldn't be able to be so grounded without him. I also want to say happy birthday to Joel, who shares the same birthday. Happy birthday. And I'd like to welcome Quetzaltatl, yes, who she opened up the beautiful ceremony. She's our grizzly mother, you know, protective indigenous support and guidance. And so I'd like to bring her on for the closing prayer as well. And just to let you know, there's already some magic happening regarding the next conference. And I keep saying it's going to be Brazil. And yeah, I really feel the plants are coming together. I feel like ayahuasca and cannabis are coming together. And so mark your calendars, possibly for next August or September. There might be a continuation of this talk. And I already talked to our sponsor, Namaste, and he's like, yeah, definitely, we're situated in Brazil. And I talked to Dr. John Bidmar. He's like, yeah, I live some of my time in Brazil. So the magic is already happening. We'll probably also do another community gathering in Victoria. I think that's the next spot that really needs to be illuminated and supported with their community as well. So thank you again to all the panelists who came and said yes and trusted this process. And I hope to see all of you guys next year. Thank you for coming out. Thank you for being part of the community. Thank you. Thank you.
Hello, darling. Oh, good. Hi, everyone. Congratulations to all the speakers who made this gathering a positive success. I'd like to ask all the organizers who made this particular gathering happen, stand up.
Come on stage.
Come on stage, please.
No,
stay here. Yeah, it's perfect. So please come forward if you helped Salome and Sam organize this gathering. Those of you that are packing up your gatherings, your goods. Also, this next little portion of my thanks for being to Salome for calling me to be a part of this gathering. It is empowering. It is overwhelming to know that we have a paradigm shift moving entirely from gas and oil to hemp-based products and from pharmaceuticals to medicine or cannabis. And so as a cannabis user and a hopeful hemp builder, I would like to congratulate all of you who made this gathering a success. And I'm learning guitar. I've always sung with a drum in hand because of my birthright as a Coast Salish woman, Stalo, one of 54 tribes. But I recently picked up the guitar as a form of medicine because over my lifetime, I've spent 25 years in court over fish. And so now I'm joining Jody in the movement with our cannabis and hemp. I go to Mark and Jody's BCMP often. It is a very welcoming environment. On Tuesday nights, there are jam nights. I've only participated in one or two. I think I was only about 50 hours old in music, but now I'm about 210 hours old. So I'd like to share a song that I'm working on and dedicate it to marijuana, cannabis, our rooted sister. And I'd like to dedicate it to each and every one of you for making this gathering so positive. And what a lovely time it was learning and listening and hearing all the contributions of the people from around the world. It's awesome, it's amazing. We do have a chance, we do have hope. And so with that, I'd like to hope that everyone is more empowered with this gathering and that we'll see each other again.